What's going on? Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It is heard live every day from noon to 3 on WBT Radio in Charlotte. And if you want exclusive content, like invitations to events, the weekly live stream, my daily show prep with all the links, become a patron. Go to thepetecallinershow.com. Make sure you hit the subscribe button. Get every episode for free right to your smartphone or tablet. And again, thank you so much for your support. So you might want to sit down for this one. Iran has started up new centrifuges so they can enrich uranium and get closer to making nuclear weapons. I am as shocked as anybody. Guys, I'm starting to get the feeling that Iran might be dangerous, right? I think that might be a little dangerous. The Associated Press reports, quote, Iran has started up new cascades of advanced centrifuges and plans to install others in the coming weeks after facing criticism over its nuclear program. This according to the United Nations Atomic Watchdog, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, or IAEA. Either way. Spinning up new centrifuges further advances Iran's nuclear program, which already enriches uranium at near weapons-grade levels, and they boast a stockpile enough for several nuclear bombs. If it chose to pursue them, which they have assured everybody that they do not intend to use this enriched uranium, whose only purpose is to make nuclear weapons, they're not going to make them into nuclear weapons. The acknowledgement from the IAEA did not include any suggestion that Iran planned to go to higher enrichment levels amid wider tensions between Tehran and the West as the Israel-Hamas war rages in the Gaza Strip. What's that got to do with their nuclear ambitions? Huh. That's weird. Why would you just bring in that Israeli-Hamas thing? Why? The IAEA said that its inspectors verified Monday that Iran had begun feeding uranium into three cascades of advanced IR-4 and IR-6 centrifuges at its Natanz enrichment facility. Cascades are a group of centrifuges that spin uranium gas together to more quickly enrich the uranium. So far, Iran has been enriching uranium in those cascades up to 2% purity. Iran already enriches uranium up to 60%, a short technical step away from weapons grade levels of 90%. Very close. Iran also plans to install 18 cascades of centrifuges that are called the IR-2Ms at this same facility. And they're going to install 8 other cascade centrifuges, the IR-6 variety, at its Fordo nuclear site. Meanwhile, a former top security official with Iran's theocracy named Ali Shamkhani, or Ali Sham for short, he still advises Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And he wrote on the social media platform Twitter, formerly X, that Tehran remains committed to nuclear safeguards, but it will not bow to pressure. Quote, the U.S. and some Western countries would dismantle Iran's nuclear industry if they could. Yes. Sorry. Yep. I would. If I could just say, you know, you get to have this, you don't get to have that, whatever. If it was just up to me, yeah, we'd totally dismantle their program. Absolutely. They have all sorts of energy production available to them with all of their gas and oil and such. They don't need nuclear weapons. They don't need a nuclear program. They claim it's for peaceful purposes, but they're always gaming the system, gaming the watchdog agency. They are a signatory to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. And they have pledged to allow the IAEA to visit its atomic sites to ensure that its program is peaceful. Tehran also agreed to additional oversight from the IAEA as part of the 2015 nuclear deal that was negotiated by Hamas, or Ben Rhodes. That was his nickname. They called him Hamas. Well, not the watchdog, but people in the White House, they called him Hamas. But yeah, that was their brainchild in the Obama administration. But for years, Iran keeps curtailing inspectors' access to sites while also not fully answering questions about other sites where nuclear material has been found in the past. Look, I don't want to assume the worst here. You know, the peaceful theocracy of Iran, they're just looking to spur growth, you know, and you need energy to do that. And so why not nuclear, right? Why not? Meanwhile, an American nonprofit that published the writings of a Hamas affiliate who held three Israelis hostage has ties to the Iranian regime. Oh, and Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is the quote, news outlet that is funded by Qatar. It served as a leading mouthpiece for Hamas. Washington Free Beacon has the analysis by Adam Credo. Israeli authorities confirmed over the weekend that three of their hostages were held in the home of Abdallah Al-Jamal, an Al Jazeera contributor who most frequently wrote for a little-known website called Palestine Chronicle. The Palestine Chronicle is based in Palestine. No, I'm just kidding. It's not. It's in America. It's based in America. Yeah. Al-Jamal's writings were featured extensively on the site, which is registered as a nonprofit in Washington State. Al-Jamal even filed dispatches during the time he is alleged to have housed the Israeli captives. So he's got Israeli hostages imprisoned in his attic, and he's downstairs banging out blog posts for an American-based nonprofit. Little is known about the Palestine Chronicle's donors and financial status. The group's IRS tax records do not list detailed information. Its founder and its editor is a guy named Ramzi Baroud. And Ramzi formerly served as an editor and executive for Al Jazeera, which was recently outlawed in Israel for providing support to Hamas. Ramzi Baroud, defended Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack on Israel. And he has written for another outlet called Kayan International. That outlet is funded by Iran's supreme leader, which is totally not interested in getting nuclear weapons. At least six of the outlet's published writers have also appeared on Iranian state-controlled propaganda sites that the U.S. government seized back in 2020. Why? Glad you asked. They were seized because they were part of an influence operation run by Tehran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC. Nothing to see here at all. Okay, if you're listening to this podcast, you are obviously paying attention to the world around us. You also have really great taste, I might add. But if you haven't started getting prepared for various emergencies, I gotta ask, what are you waiting for? Please call my friends Bill and Jan at Carolina Readiness Supply, and they'll help get you started. If you have no idea how to start, they can help you. If you're an experienced prepper, they can help you too. Being prepared is just smart. We've already established that you're smart. I mean, you listen to this podcast after all. So let's put those smarts into action. Go to CarolinaReadiness.com. That's CarolinaReadiness.com or call them at 828-226-7239. Carolina Readiness Supply has 2,000 square feet of supplies as well as educational materials that you're going to need for any kind of emergency. Veteran-owned Carolina Readiness Supply. Will you be ready when the lights go out? Let us, ham and tomato, let us head on over to the phones and talk with Jeff. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I was just listening. I wonder if anybody's found it ironic, the fact that Joe Biden and the Democrats don't seem to have any problem with Iran developing more nuclear power, yet the same group wants to put us on wind and solar power only. Is that strange?
Yeah. All right. Well, nuclear for thee, not for me, is the credo. Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe the Iranian regime, they're just, maybe they're doing it for environmental purposes, right? Because it's not going to emit any carbon, right? So maybe that's what this is about.
Well, I'm afraid that Iran, being run by a bunch of crazies anyway, it may kind of it may blow us off the face of the earth.
Yeah, well,
or
I mean,
Israel, one of the two. But hey, what's the problem?
Right. I mean, it like just because Israel is like literally like a 7-minute nuclear ride away from Iran, I'm sure they got nothing to worry about on this.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah. All right, Jeff.
Good weekend. I appreciate it.
Yeah, buddy. Appreciate the call. Have a good weekend yourself. Yeah. Would the Iron Dome be able to shoot down a nuclear war? Oh, I wonder if they shoot it out of the sky while it's over Lebanon. And then they get the fallout. I wonder if Iran has contemplated. I'm just kidding. They don't care about innocent people. Okay, so while the terror group is known to employ, this is Hamas, while the terror, which is, by the way, you know, a proxy for Iran in the region, while the terrorist group is known to employ regional reporters who disseminate their propaganda, the hostage taker in this case, Abdallah al-Jamal, his connection to an American website registered as a nonprofit raises questions about how pro-jihadi propaganda outlets are steadily feeding information to an English-speaking audience. The Palestine Chronicle, based and registered as a nonprofit group in Olympia, Washington, received its tax-exempt status in 2012, according to the IRS records, which is interesting. So they got nonprofit status, 2012. Do you remember who couldn't get nonprofit status in 2012? Do you remember? That's right. It was the Tea Party groups. Yeah. Remember, they were getting slow-rolled. So they couldn't participate in the election against Barack Obama. That one field officer in Cincinnati, right, that was their decision. That's all that happened. Okay. Records filed with the state of Washington show that the website's parent company, an organization called People Media Project, took in over $91,000 in 2 years ago. 3 years ago, they took in about $59,000, and then before that, they took in $92,000. The outlet claims to be entirely funded by its readers. Now, after news broke that al-Jamal, the reporter, who just happened to also be moonlighting as a kidnapper, as a hostage holder, the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Jason Smith called for the revocation of the People Media Project's tax-exempt status. No, that might be a bit too far. I mean, are you saying that we're not allowed to engage in terrorism as a nonprofit? We're not making money. All of our money is being used to support the mission of, you know, killing Jews, spreading propaganda to get people to kill Jews, right? Like that's, but we're not making money here. We're clearly a nonprofit. The Palestine Chronicle editor-in-chief, Ramzi Barood, is affiliated with a bunch of foreign think tanks as well. Back in 2022, this guy published an article with the Iran state-controlled Kayan International outlet. He's got bylines on two websites, one called the American Herald Tribune and Critical Studies. Sorry. Those are two different publications. One's called Critical Studies, which is just some like really esoteric kind of lesson that's taught only at Harvard Law. All right. Nobody even knows anything about critical studies. The Justice Department, by the way, seized both of them in 2020 for being part of an influence operation run by Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Also with bylines at the Palestine Chronicle nonprofit, Robert Inlakesh. He's got an author page that lists him as a contributor at the American Herald Tribune, the one that was shut down. Jeremy Salt, another Palestine Chronicle writer and one-time advisory board member for the organization, also has an author page at the American Herald Tribune. He wrote 8 pieces for that website. There's another, Jamal Kanj. He's a contributor to Palestine Chronicle. He has also published at the American Herald Tribune, as did Palestine Chronicle contributor Yves Engler. I'm starting to see a connection here, guys. It's almost as if these writers, after their one website got shut down because it was funded by Iran's Revolutionary Guard, they just kind of migrated over to the Palestine Chronicle. The editor, Ramzi Barood, one time wrote a poem, and he dedicated it to Afzal Guru, who was convicted in 2001 of carrying out a terrorist attack on India's parliament, killing 9 people. An archived webpage detailing members of the Palestine Chronicle's advisory board listed Daoud Abdullah. He's the director of the Middle East Monitor, a nonprofit news outlet that focuses on regional issues. Abdullah served as the Muslim Council of Britain's Deputy Director General back in 2009, and he faced calls to resign his post after he signed a public declaration supporting Hamas's military operations. Abdullah also led the group's boycott of the Holocaust Memorial Day. Remember that a couple of weeks ago? Same guy. Another one-time Palestine Chronicle advisory board member is named Salman Abu Sitta. You'll never catch him standing. Sitta is his name. He penned a piece in the virulently anti-Zionist blog Mandawais, claiming that Hamas did not rape Israelis, nor did they behead babies, although the empirical evidence produced by the Israelis shows otherwise. Other writers published at the Palestine Chronicle, including Iqbal Jassid, he praised Hamas's slaughter of Israelis and defended the terrorist group's, quote, right to armed struggle. Okay, so that's the Palestine Chronicle. Just in case you've got that website bookmarked, you may want to just remove the bookmark, lest, you know, at some point Homeland Security starts knocking on your door. Just a heads up on that one. But there is a protest paradigm. Danielle K. Brown, writing at Scientific America, headline, "The Protest Paradigm Shows What's Wrong with Media Coverage of Student Activism." Danielle K. Brown, writing at, this is published at scientificamerican.com, but it's part of, I think it's also in a publication called The Conversation. Yes, it was originally published on The Conversation. And thanks to Monica for sending me the link to this story. But I don't open links, so you can send it. And if there's like a description of it, then I'll go and I'll search for it myself, which is what I did here. Okay. But she has spent more than a decade, Danielle Brown, has spent more than a decade researching extensively, exploring trends in how the media shapes narratives around different kinds of demonstrations. Reporting on the campus encampments by large parts of the media fits a general pattern of protest coverage. She says it focuses more on the drama of the disruption rather than the underlying reasons behind it. And that can leave audiences uninformed about the nuances of the protests and the movements behind them. For example, Marxists. Okay, she doesn't say that. I'm adding that. Marxists destabilizing Western society, right? That's behind the protests. There's really not a lot of nuance going on here. That's what it is. Now, certain people may be, you know, enticed to go march for the, you know, jihadist death cult. That's possible. They don't know all of the ins and outs. All they know is like, oh, there are people dying and I don't want people dying. Okay. Yeah, I don't like the idea of people dying in war either. But the protest movement, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. I keep saying this because I recognize what she is pointing out here, and she is correct here that media does do a pretty poor job of describing for its audience what the true nature of the protests are about. Now, I suspect she's going to come to a different conclusion as to what she thinks the true nature of the protests are about. I feel like I got a pretty good idea. It's the same playbook over and over and over again. It's the same crew. They're swapping out their Black Bloc Antifa garb for keffiyehs. That's it. Same people, same groups. Just what, yesterday or no? Maybe it was Monday. I forget. I did the story on Patagonia, the clothing maker, right? And, oh, look at that. We've been donating to this group, and we thought they were totally about the environment, but they've been funneling money into this pro-Palestine activism. Oh, wow, I'm shocked. Not really. The issue is always the revolution. They are agents of destabilization in our society. That's what they are. She goes on to say core elements, grievances, demands, disruption, confrontation, and spectacle are present in nearly all protests. But to the media, some elements are more newsworthy than others, with confrontation and spectacle often topping the list. Correct. When people get into fights with others, when people harass and intimidate, when people block traffic, when people strip down naked, when they do all of these things in order to gain attention from the media obliges them. It gives them the oxygen. As a result, these elements tend to be covered more often than others. I'm old enough to remember the Moral Monday marches. You remember that period of time? Mm-hmm. For people who were not in North Carolina at the time, Republicans had just won majorities in the state legislature, and the Democrat Party was broke and broken. They had had a series of scandals going back, gosh, almost like 20 years. The Speaker of the House went to federal prison. The governor lost his license to practice law due to corruption. Meg Scott Phipps, the agriculture commissioner, she went to federal prison. Frank Balance, congressman, the state party had like two back-to-back executive directors that had to quit because they were accused of sexual harassment. They couldn't even pay the rent on their state party headquarters. It was so bad that sitting U.S. Senator Kay Hagan, a Democrat, could not use the state Democrat Party in order to organize her reelection campaign. She couldn't rely on them, so she actually went through the Wake County Democrat Party. And so against that backdrop, you have this hollowed out shell of a party that has just crashed and burned after a century and a half in power in North Carolina. And into that void steps Reverend William Barber and his, what was it, the People's, now it's the People's Campaign Against Poverty or whatever it is now. But he stepped in there and he allowed Democrats and leftists and media, but I repeat myself, allowed them to organize around something that didn't have the stench of corruption and failure that the state Democrat Party had. And he then whipped up teachers through the union to march on the state General Assembly. And that was those were the biggest crowds he got, was the demands for teacher pay increases, which, by the way, had been frozen by Democrats because they had so poorly budgeted for so long that there were structural billion-dollar-plus deficits annually. And so when the recession hit, they had no rainy day fund. They had nothing to backstop, and they had to furlough teachers. They had to freeze their step pay increases. And so then the Republicans win. The Democrat Party is in no position, like financially or logistically, to mount any kind of opposition. And so here comes the Moral Monday marchers. And these people would go in and do in North Carolina what occurred years prior in Wisconsin, where they took over the legislative hall. Right? They took over the chambers, preventing lawmakers from engaging in the work of the people. Ironically, these very same types of tactics are what led to some of the flimsiest charges that were filed against the J6 protesters, right? Interfering with or obstructing with an official proceeding or something like that. See, it's different when Democrats do it, right? It's for the people. And by the way, as soon as Republicans overhauled the salary schedule and started increasing the teacher pay, the numbers of the Moral Marchers, Moral Monday marchers dwindled. But also, you know, Barber would go down and do press conferences. I think he would do them on like a Thursday or something, maybe Friday, talking about the next Monday's march. And so for media, these were easy stories to turn. you got a lot of, especially for the TV folks, you have a lot of interesting video. Like, why do you think video of news stories about apartment fires and house fires, why do you think those are so prevalent in newscasts, TV newscasts? It's because it's fire. Oh my gosh, look at that thing's on fire. And people want to watch it. People look at it. Legislative meetings? Boring. That's why you get the cutaway shots of, like, you know, papers on a table, or like lawmakers leaning back in their chair reading some piece of legislation, like over the glasses that are slid down their nose. Or you get the zoom in on the person, you know, writing with a pen or pencil on something. You get these cutaway shots because there's no other action happening. But if you're able to whip up a mob and take over the lobby of the legislature, well, then that's interesting video. Right, the incentives are aligned for media to cover these protests. And what Barber would do is he would go out on a Thursday, do a press conference, and that allowed them to allow the story to have legs, as they say. The story's got legs, so you can keep it rolling. It's a good media strategy. I'm like, tip of the hat to Reverend Barber, because he knew that media needed to fill the news hole. There's a hole. 5 o'clock, 5:30, 6 o'clock, 6:30, 11 o'clock, right? You have to fill this time with something. And so if he goes out and does a press conference and he says, you know, some stuff in a, you know, in this flourishing oratory, and then you can use B-roll of last week's protest march. And that's interesting to watch. And once you have enough of the B-roll, well, now you could just keep using it over and over and over again, and you could just kind of fill the time. And if you don't think the professional activist crowd doesn't know this, you're crazy. They are well aware of what they need to do to feed the beast. Because you always got to feed that beast. You got to make slot. You got to fill the news hole. The piece is at scientificamerican.com. Danielle K. Brown, researcher in this field. And she said that the coverage of protests tends to headline the parts of the protests that are sensational and disruptive. Wait. Media does that? Media focuses on the sensational and disruptive? And this neglects the political substance of the protest, she says. The grievances, demands, and agendas are often left in the shadows, which I would submit is the entire point, right? That's why activists are gluing their hands to art. The point is irrelevant, right? Do you think, like, at some point you think, oh, you know what? I was all for, oil and burning lots of oil. And then I saw these two people go into the Museum of Art up in New York. And I was like, what are they doing? They glued themselves to a painting. And I said, oh, now I got to stop using oil. How absurd do you have to be to think that that's the ones who put their hands into quickset concrete, right? And then for some reason we feel the need for public servants to chisel them out? No. Like, that stinks. I don't know why you would have cemented yourself to a curb, but good luck with that. I'm under no obligation to rescue your hand out of the concrete that you put it in. The whole point is to disrupt. That's it. It's sowing chaos. The pattern is referred to, she says, as the protest paradigm. Movements that seek to disrupt the status quo are the most likely to receive initial coverage that frames protesters as criminal, irrelevant, trivial, or illegitimate components of the political system. Because they usually are. Right? They usually are. There was a protest in Raleigh. There was a march on the legislature, rally at the legislature for daycare. We're going to cover that in the next hour. They did not, you know, set themselves on fire. Right? They did not harass Jews. They came out, they made their positions known. They want more government money. I know that's a total shocker too. The protests began, these ones in 2023, escalated onto the campus encampments. She says, rather than focusing on the grievance of the protesters, concerns about the deaths and injuries and looming famine affecting Palestinians, the reports of the campus encampments has been about the confrontations between protesters and police and have become central to the news media coverage. She talks about who gets quoted and who doesn't. There are commercial reasons why some newsrooms focus on the spectacle and the confrontation. The old journalism adage, if it bleeds, it leads. I would add, if it's sex, it's next. It still prevails in many newsroom decisions. Why? I ask. Why would that still prevail? Because that's what people want to see. That's what people watch. Oh, no, no, I know. If you're put in a focus group, you're totally going to say you watch for the weather and the good stories. But that's not true. Okay? It's not true. People watch, or news outlets stack their programs based on what people want to read and see and listen to. That's how that happens. Okay? I remember there was the, during the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton scandal, right? People were like, oh, I'm so tired of hearing about Monica Lewinsky. Yeah, until you put her on the cover of your magazine and it flies off the shelves. Everybody wanted to read about it, but nobody wanted to admit that they wanted to read about it. For the initial weeks of the campus protest, she says this penchant for sensationalism showed up in the focus on chaos, clashes, and arrests, but it's a decision that delegitimizes protest aims. Well, then maybe don't set up the encampments. If the point of the protest is to disrupt in order to draw attention to your cause, but all the coverage is just about the disruption, maybe try a different tactic, you know? She says this delegitimization is aided by the sourcing routines that journalists often fall back on to tell stories quickly and without legal consequence. So in breaking news situations, journalists tend to gravitate towards and directly quote sources that hold status, like government and university officials. This is because reporters may already have an established relationship with such officials who often have dedicated media relations teams. All of that is true. And in the case of campus protests in particular, reporters have faced difficulty connecting with protest participants directly. Right, because they get blocked. Because the organizers know that a lot of the protesters are dumb. They don't know what they are there for. And when you start asking them questions, if you get a rare journalist who shows up at a protest and starts asking probative questions about why people are there and what they know about the actual issue they are there to protest, you find out pretty damn fast they don't know what the hell they're talking about. They don't know why they're there. Maybe they're there to pick up chicks. I don't know. They are not informed. They'd spout a couple of slogans that are also being chanted behind them, and that's about it. So, yeah, a lot of the protest leaders are dumb. The media shapes the way most people understand these types of events. But as coverage of the protests across universities has shown, often the focus is on the spectacle rather than the substance, which I would submit is often very stupid. It is. The substance is itself stupid. And that's why they don't want to focus. The protesters don't want you to focus on the issues at play. They just want you to do what they tell you to do. That's it. That's why they're there. That's why they're being disruptive. Do what we say and the disruption stops. It's extortion. That's what it is. All right, let me jump over to the phones and get Jesse on. Hello, Jesse. Welcome to the show.
Brent, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. What's going on?
Hey, I just wanted to have your feedback on the Josh Stein political ad. It looks more like a breaking news story than a political ad for, you know, him, you know, finally solving the rape kid crisis in Charlotte.
Uh-huh.
It's been going on for a long time. And I'll hang up and listen to your thoughts on it and your feedback, and I appreciate you taking my call.
So what specifically is the question? Is
there a specific? Well, if you watch the ad, the Josh Stein ad, they take little snippets of breaking news stories.
Yeah.
But almost, it appears as if it's breaking news that Josh Stein just solved the rape kit crisis in Charlotte. And that's the feeling I'm getting from it. And I just was wondering if anybody's seen it and what their thoughts are.
Okay, so I have not seen the ad. I've heard about the ad. I've not read the transcript or watched it. But I appreciate the call, Jesse. So this is a common tactic that campaigns do, right? They will pretend to be newsy, right? And what they're doing is they're using the, at least the perceived, credibility of news organizations to tell you the truth. They're using that in order to advance their agenda. And campaigns of both parties do it. And by the way, political reporters and media outlets know this as well. When you do a story with a blaring headline indicting a certain candidate, they know that that headline is going to get ripped out of the story and show up in a campaign ad. They are all aware of it. That's the game. All right, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I could not do the show without your support and the support of the businesses that advertise on the podcast. So if you'd like, please support them too and tell them you heard it here. You can also become a patron at my Patreon page or go to thepetecallinershow.com. Again, thank you so much for listening, and don't break anything while I'm gone.